Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, my two compatriots, there is Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hello.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello.
Hello. We are here today to talk about two films. The first will be Force Majeure, the foreign film that has been sweeping the nation with the force of an avalanche. There's been a lot of talk about this, so we're very excited that we're finally going to be able to join the discussion. Then we will talk about Inherent Vice, the newest film by Film Stage Show favorite Paul Thomas Anderson, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Josh Brolin, and just a lot of other people. There's like, it's going to be like a Gone Girl, where I could just keep going over and over and over.
Did you pronounce it Joaquin?
Joaquin, did I?
Yeah.
I do have a little bit of a chest cold, so I'm going to use that as an excuse. Joaquin. Anyway, before we get into that, the usual housekeeping stuff that we should talk about. First, as always, you can email us at podcast@filmstage.com. If you have any long-form thoughts you'd like to share with us, you can always tweet to @filmstageshow. And we'll be able to hear from you there. Also, keep an eye on that, because we have some contests and stuff that happen every now and then. And we also often release very interesting little tidbits about the movies that we talk to, things like behind-the-scenes photos and interviews. In addition, you can find all of us at thefilmstage.com, where you can comment on the article page for this podcast. Aside from that, as always, comments, ratings on iTunes, and that is that. So with all that out of the way, and with nothing else to really talk about, I think we can get into our reviews. The first is Force Majeure. This is a movie that wound up on a lot of people's top 10 film of the year list for 2014. We're just getting to it now because it's been expanding slowly, and I want to say to all of our DC listeners that there's actually going to be a retrospective on all the films by filmmaker Ruben Östlund. I think that's how you pronounce that. Never quite sure what to do with an umlaut. At the AFI Silver in Silver Spring, and he will actually be there to talk about Force Majeure this coming Thursday, which I believe is the 14th or 15th. So keep an eye out for that. Force Majeure is a... Would you call this a drama? I guess it's a drama. It's a drama with an undercurrent of strangely dark comedy. It's about a family that's on a ski vacation in France. And what happens when the husband makes a fateful decision during what appears to be a cataclysmic avalanche? Danny King, what did you think of Force Majeure?
So I saw this film maybe a month or two ago, and it would have been nice to have a chance to rewatch it, but I ended up giving the second viewing to the film we will be discussing later. But my first viewing, I sort of in the majority on this one and really liking it. One thing I did the other day was watch one of his previous films called Involuntary, and what that film is sort of, it's like five or six different plot lines, all told, pretty much every scene told in a single take with the static camera. And it's sort of a similar mixture of like natural observation of human behavior that, given the situations that Östlund is exploring, happen to turn out very uncomfortably. There's one plot line in the film concerns a woman, an actress who's on a bus, and in the bathroom she accidentally breaks like the curtain rod of the window in the bathroom, and the bus driver assumes that the culprits are these like teenage kind of punks or whatever. And it's actually, now that I think about it, I don't think we ever see the teenage punks on screen. They're just sort of off screen, and we see the bus driver talking to them. But he sort of takes a stand, and he's like, I'm not going to drive this bus until someone admits to breaking the curtain rod. And so they're just repeatedly agonizing shots of this woman, and it's like 3 or 4 hours after, like, the bus has been stolen. So it's like almost impossible for her to, like, come forward now and maintain any sort of respect. And the way that threat is resolved is just amazing. But anyway, the difference is, like, Force Majeure is, you know, just one streamlined story of this family. It's probably worth mentioning that the movie's kind of, the incident that sets it off, in which the father sort of abandons his family in the face of this oncoming avalanche, has some similarities with a film called The Loneliest Planet from a couple of years ago. But whereas that type of event happened like halfway through The Loneliest Planet, it happens at the beginning of Force Majeure. So the bulk of the film is the fallout from that. And I find he's been getting some comparisons to like Michael Haneke with this fixed take style. But I find his compositions a lot funnier. There's one that I keep thinking about where it's the four members of the family are sleeping in like identical pajamas, that I found hilarious. And then in other times in like its best scenes, it sort of mixes the hilarious with like the ridiculously uncomfortable. I think one scene I really liked is when the father is sitting beside a pool or something, or maybe he's just sitting outside, and it's like some woman points him out for being attractive, I think, and then comes back and says she was actually talking about someone else.
Which is one of those situations where you're like, why would you feel the need to correct yourself?
And it's like, I guess that is maybe that's a director just kind of playing with his characters, but the way that he reacts and his friend reacts is so funny, where it's like they almost get up and they like need to like hit something. They're just so taken aback by the twist. And then there are other funny touches, like Brady Corbet shows up for a scene,
it's so weird. I like freaked out when I saw him.
Yeah,
I was like, oh my god, it's Brady.
This is a weird little thing that happened over the fall festival circuit, where he showed up in 3 foreign productions very briefly, because he's also in Eden and Clouds of Sils Maria. He only shows up for about, at Clouds of Sils Maria, he shows up like at the very end for 45 seconds.
America's greatest export is Brady Corbet.
I'm not sure about that, but
it was funny because I remember talking to him and I was like, you seem to be in a lot of like foreign productions and blah blah blah, like, you know, what is it about that? And you know, we talked about it and he's like, you know, I just look for the best directors and everything. And I'm like, that makes sense, but like for 2 minutes each, like what is like, you're a good actor. I don't know that you really had to stretch your muscles that much to be part of the dinner scene in Force Majeure. I'm still happy to see him, but I was just like, is that my man Brady? That's awesome.
But yeah, so that was funny. So yeah, those are some initial thoughts. Overall, I would be inclined to agree with the majority on this one and find the film, you know, really funny and uncomfortable. And I'm probably still working out the ending sequence. I don't know if we'll get to talk about that, but
yeah,
we
may have a brief spoiler section just to see if we can draw up a, not even a consensus, but just any kind of read on that. Nick Newman, for now, why don't you tell us what you thought of Force Majeure?
The Majeure Majority, eh, Danny?
Force Majority is more like it, am I right?
I'm going to start a really intense online group just supporting the majority for Force Majeure.
So, regarding Force Majeure, you know, it's no secret that the reaction you have to a film depends greatly on the mood you're in when you're actually watching it. It's not something that some critics like to admit because it's seen as a sign of weakness, but I think it's a pretty essential part of the film viewing experience. And So I'm wondering if perhaps I just was not exactly in the mood for this film when I actually sat down to watch it. And I kind of had to watch it at a certain point because I was on this road trip this week and it was a Friday night and the screener was going to expire on Saturday morning, so I really had no choice. So Force Majeure kind of didn't really hit me that much, at least upon an initial viewing, because I kind of found something tiring about the experience. What I called in a tweet, a contempt for every living creature, that I...
Holy shit.
That I just... not me, what the movie has.
Right, like a Michael Haneke film.
Exactly, and I'll get to why that comparison is problematic. Not the comparison itself, why the comparison raises problems in just a second, but as it stands, I found the film just kind of mean in a way that was not necessarily appealing to me. I found it sort of taking what felt like kind of easy shots to me, really. You know, this film presents in an austere, locked position the abject horror that is using an electric toothbrush. And I just really was just kind of not feeling it when I watched it. It just felt like too assaultive. You know, these rigidly locked compositions set to classical music that I guess is supposed to create some sort of humorous, ironic juxtaposition, but it at once feels very obvious and sort of opaque in the sense that it's kind of presenting this and assuming that the effect of it will be, you know, so immediately funny that nothing else needs to be stated. Whereas, again, it kind of reminded me of something like Michael Haneke, who I kind of run hot and cold on. Sometimes I think he's very on point, and sometimes I think he just kind of needs to sit down and chill out for a second. And this, to me, kind of felt like, you know, what's a Haneke film I don't really much like? Kind of felt like Time of the Wolf.
Oh, no. You don't like that one?
No,
that's like my favorite of his. Even when we agree on a director, we can't agree on the fucking films.
Like Time of the Wolf, or you know, what's the 71 Fragments as well. It kind of had that air to it, sort of this very superior quality that I just kind of was not really in the mood to see. It hit me as very false. It hit me as kind of easy to coordinate this sort of thing, you know, this bourgeois critique that observes them in a very austere, measured style so that you can see in a single image who they are, how dead inside they truly are. And I don't know, for me, the whole thing was only intermittently funny. The film definitely makes its stabs at comedy, and really the only moments that made me laugh were a climactic crying scene was one, and everything from the main character's friend, who has a big red beard.
And is on Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I didn't recognize it.
Also, I'm insanely jealous of that beard.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Just wanted to fall asleep in it.
You know, I saw John Wick last week, and I was surprised that the sort of lead shithead in the movie was played by the same guy who plays Theon Greyjoy.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones, so I guess I'm not good at recognizing these actors. But anyway, for me, the whole experience was just a bit tiring. It was kind of, you know, I kind of want to say, all right, let's cool it here for a second. Let's see these people as people, as people who contain multitudes, not are just absolutely horrible in every direction. I mean, I found that sort of the husband is this blustering idiot who has a giant ego. And, you know, the wife is kind of... The wife is the kind of character about whom, you know, the term hysteria used to be used. And hysteria is by no means an acceptable descriptor nowadays. And yet it is this kind of archetype around whom that sort of term was built. And so I kind of found that there was no proper relay going on there. There wasn't much of a volley. It was just kind of one-sided. And for me, the experience was... It wasn't redeemed by much. That's the problem, is that Östlund, as it might be pronounced... again, his sense of formalism felt very familiar, and it felt very easy, really, to observe things in this manner. I mean, if you've seen, you know, any, like, European art house film that has won a major award at some kind of festival over the past 15 years, you could probably do this in your sleep, I think. Something about the compositions feel very easy to me. And
I will agree with that.
And I don't think that he's really capturing much in a significant way. I don't think any of the images are actually in dialogue with the material itself. So, yeah, overall, I'm relatively negative on the film. But again, maybe if I had watched it in a different setting, I would. Also, I fell asleep during the last shot. I probably shouldn't admit that. but the last shot goes on for something like 2 minutes, and I was kind of lying on my couch, and then, like, I thought I blinked or something, and then I opened my eyes, and it was halfway through the end credits. And it turns out that, in fact, I rewound it.
Okay, I was going to say, because there is a last line that I think is important to understanding the film. I enjoyed this film. I actually really enjoyed it. I don't think that it's as deep as a lot of people seem to think it is. I've been hearing about this film since Toronto, since the International Film Festival, where it played. I don't think it premiered there, but it did play there. And I don't know. There was something about the compositions, like Nick said, I'm a big fan of the Michael Haneke lock camera sitting in a single place, but there was something that was almost like, and the environment that they're in is so beautiful that it almost felt like a cheat. It's not hard to find a beautiful angle on a mountain or on a really nice resort hotel. At the same time, I thought that the acting was great. I thought that some of the individual scenes were really fantastic. The dinner with Brady in it, that was fun. The next dinner with the guy with the red beard, whose name I will never remember. I found him. His name is Christopher Hivju? No idea. I wish I was better at pronouncing foreign names. I mean, I liked that. I liked the way that played out, and it ratcheted upwards. But there's just something else. There's something weird. And there's a point in the movie where it actually got more interesting for me. And then it didn't really follow through on that all the way. It does keep its focus with this one family. But everything kind of moves so quickly through such stillness that it felt really off. Like, if this had been a normal film, even like a mumblecore film, where you're kind of able to move with briskness and then slow down when you need to and have it still feel paced similarly just because of the way it's acted and shot, I think it actually would have been better. But with this austerity, you're kind of bracketed in, and everything has to happen within like a single 7-minute shot, and so you have to move through human emotions very quickly. So the wife's distress ratchets up very quickly, at the same time very slowly, and then the husband and his slow breakdown also happens similarly, and the kids just are like immediate, because they just need to, they can't spend any time with those kids. Because you probably can't have a child actor pulling out a long take like that. But there's a point where the right after the dinner, Mats, who's a friend of this family, and his new girlfriend, who is like 20 years old, are talking about what they had just heard from the wife and the husband, Thomas and Elba. And they get into a similar fight. And it begins at the elevator and then follows into bed and then maintains itself through hours through the next night. And at that point, if the movie had shifted its full attention to those two characters, I actually think that it might have been more interesting, because it would have kind of brought into focus this idea that, like, a single moment can infect a relationship. And even the hypothetical concept of what one would do in that moment, completely divorced of the actual evidence of what a person would do in that moment, can poison a relationship. Like, I love the fact that the husband, or not the husband, but Mats, the man in that second relationship, was so, like, angry and hurt just by what he perceived that his girlfriend thought of him. And he even says, like, I can't imagine what I could have done that would make you think that about me. And that is 100% a feeling that I have had in my life. The thing where someone's like, well, you know, if you were there, you would have done this. I'm like, whoa. Why the hell is that something that you would say? What have I done that makes you think that I'm that shit of a person? And, you know, it's like, oh, I wasn't saying that. It's like, no, you must have, because only a shit person would do what you just claimed that I would do. And so then it just creates this awful cascading effect of just poison. And I kind of like the idea that even a relationship that wasn't actually tested, just through viewing the test, could find itself failing the test. But unfortunately, this movie doesn't go there. But in the whole, with all that said, I still found this very engaging. I saw it really late one night, and I was still, you know, enraptured the entire way through. Did not fall asleep like Nick. And I quite enjoyed it quite a lot.
I just have a couple of thoughts. One is that I think there is some truth to Nick's claim about there maybe being a little bit of contempt for the characters. And one thing that sort of illustrates that tension in the movie is when I saw the film in the theater, I was sort of mildly laughing throughout because I'm not like a loud person. But there was a guy in the row across from me that was cackling. And every time he would laugh, there was a woman a few rows up who would turn around and look at him like she was mad he was laughing. So it's like this two extremes that the movie is playing with, where like one person can watch it and find it hysterical and another person can be like, no, this is like way too uncomfortable, like stop laughing. And so I thought that was almost entertaining as a sideshow while I was watching the movie itself. But the other thing I would say is that while Uslan's style might be kind of a familiar art house style, I think he does bring a lot of distinctiveness to this movie, and in particular with the setting. Not even necessarily just the striking shots of the landscape, but I still remember a lot of things, the way he shot the hotel and the resort kind of being very evocative. Like there's a sort of odd recurring character of the janitor who kind of always happens to be in the hallway when the main characters are at really inopportune moments. And the other thing that brings out for me is the interest in having to watch this couple deal with their very serious problems while on vacation with their children. So it's like, it would be one thing if this woman could have a heart-to-heart with her husband, like, on their bed or something, like the other couple, but we have to see them do it in the hallway while he's, like, sitting on the ground and they sort of are, like, half-whispering. So I think there are a lot of moments throughout the film where his style sort of adds to things like that, where you're aware of the kids off-screen because of his kind of fixed-camera style. And that's sort of informing the behavior of the two main characters.
Well, that's all we're going to talk about Force Majeure today. We toyed with the idea of doing a spoiler section, but what that would basically devolve into is just trying to add our own read to an ending that I think is somewhat purposefully ambiguous. If you would like to discuss the end of Force Majeure with us, email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. I'm sure we'd be happy to share our ideas with you personally, but not a lot of reason to talk about it specifically right now, especially when we have another film to talk about. Force Majeure is out now in limited release and on VOD, so check it out. That is that for that, though. Now it's time to talk about Inherent Vice, adapted from the Thomas Pynchon novel by Paul Thomas Anderson, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. And did I say Anderson?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. This movie stars Joaquin Phoenix, Katherine Watterson, Josh Brolin, Joanna Newsom, Eric Roberts, Maya Rudolph, Reese Witherspoon, and many, many others. Here is the trailer.
If it's a quiet night out at the beach and your ex-old lady suddenly out of nowhere shows up with a story about her current billionaire land developer boyfriend and his wife and her boyfriend and a plot to kidnap the billionaire and throw him in a loony bin...
I need your help, Doc.
Maybe you should just look the other way. But if you're Doc, it may all start to get a little peculiar after that.
Michael Z. Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
Has vanished.
So where would I find him?
He's technically Jewish, but wants to be a Nazi.
And a girl don't necessarily want to get into difficulties with those folks.
You got a spare picture I could borrow? Ah!
Mm-hmm. So my hair advice is... I guess it could charitably be called Stoner Noir. We have, Doc Sportello, who smokes an undisclosed amount of grass a day and is attempting to solve a number of mysteries, and in classic noir fashion, all of the mysteries seem to be connected. The biggest, and the mystery that kicks us off, is that his ex-girlfriend, Shasta Faye Hepworth, has come back and is asking him to help her out in a situation where her new lover is going to be kidnapped and possibly committed to an insane asylum so that his wife and her lover can get his money. This is a strange film. This is not a film that you would expect it to be. So let's see what we thought about it. Nick Newman, why don't you kick us off this time? What did you think of Inherent Vice?
Well, not to sound like some elitist here, when I say that it's strange for me to be talking about this film now, because I saw it kind of a while ago. I saw it when it premiered at the New York Film Festival, which was the morning of October 4th, I guess.
Oh, you're cool. Whoa.
Anyway. It's, you know, I mean, it was a weird experience because I had to wake up at fucking 6:10 in the morning to go stand online in the rain. And, you know, you're sitting there and you're like, you're a little soaked and you're waiting to watch a movie. And that's no way to watch a movie, really. And I wrote my review of it for the Film Stage. It's been up for about a quarter of a year now, which is kind of weird. And it's one of those things where I had quite a bit to say about it. And yet, from pretty much the second the movie ended to the second my review was published, I felt pretty much the same way about it, which is to say that it's all right. It's okay. I am pretty conflicted about this film because I think that it represents for Anderson an interesting step forward, and very much a step the way he is accruing and recombining these traits that he's sort of been building up for quite a bit. I think when someone asked me the day after I saw it what I thought of it, or rather what the experience was like, I said, imagine you know, The Long Goodbye filtered through Punch Drunk Love's sensibility with the master's formal traits. And that's an interesting it's interesting to think of it in that, in those terms, because it doesn't immediately feel like that upon it doesn't immediately feel like that as it's playing. And yet, in retrospect, that seems like the only proper way to sum it up. And yet, as much as that sounds great, I found a lot of the film, kind of like Force Majeure, I found it a little tiring, and I didn't think that really it had much new to say about any of the topics it's covering, about the effects of counterculture and capitalism, about the death of counterculture in California. Really, the only times it came out in an interesting manner was when Anderson does something with his camera that I think coincides with the material very well. Again, sort of in relation to Force Majeure and a problem I had there. But this movie's, I think, is sort of a, you know, eat your cake and have it too problem, which is that it attempts to go through this very twisty, knotty narrative while also being kind of a loose-limbed, you know, wacky time, and I don't think those two mesh together very well. Mm-hmm. I think that there is something that feels kind of incompatible in the way that they're working with one another. I just was kind of, because at one turn I'd be interested in what exactly is going on with Doc Sportello, the next I'd be laughing very hard at a hippie running through an office carrying a steering wheel. I like that stuff, but when they were kind of clashing with each other, which I felt was often, I found myself almost totally disengaged. And there is kind of an issue where the problem I have a lot of times when you take a great author and you transplant their work to the screen, it was kind of a problem I actually had the first time I saw The Counselor, you might recall, which is that there's something about saying the words out loud that I find a little difficult to handle in a way. Because when I read Thomas Pynchon, I read it in a very specific voice, just as when I read Cormac McCarthy, I read in a very specific voice.
Right.
And I feel like there's something that's lost when actors are actually speaking it out loud. I actually just recently reread The Crying of Lot 49, which is a novella that Pynchon wrote in the early 60s. And reading it kind of helped clarify why I am mixed on this film, is because I just feel like this is shit that you can't really say out loud. I feel like there's something about it that kind of needs to be internalized. And it sort of became this muddle for me, where I don't think that really anything about, again, I don't think the idea of, you know, counterculture dying out in favor of land developers is really a new here. I really hate hippies so much, and so
yeah.
watching hippies go like, oh man, there's a time we could just go to the beach and smoke, man. And oh man, remember when you could just hang out, man, and listen to music, man? It's like, God, I don't care. I'm sorry that, you know, you couldn't, you know, sit around all day instead of working, but that's not really my problem anymore, is it? Because it's 2015 or 2014 when I saw it, but, you know, really not much of a difference in time. It's 44 years difference, and I feel like after a while, it's, you know, it's like, move the fuck on, dude. And, you know, the vision of, like, a lost California, I don't care. Like, I really, and I find that sort of, again, the labyrinthian plotting is working against the mood that it's trying to establish. I like the idea of a film about, you know, the counterculture and the emerging upper class, you know, clashing with each other and having to, in some sense, work together. I like the idea of certain sensibilities that those two embody in terms of how you tell a story coming together, but I don't think it exactly flowed. And yet I like the movie. I know I'm saying a lot of negative things here, but I did like the film. I think there is a lot to admire in it. For one thing, I think it's interesting how Anderson is taking these, you know, Pynchon sentences and kind of translating them visually, not the dialogue itself, but taking the way that, you know, when you read Pynchon, it can be a very disorienting experience because sometimes a particular noun or a particular adverb will be in the middle of a sentence and it doesn't feel like it should be there. It's almost like the word is, you know, the word is printed slightly sideways and you have to read it slightly sideways and then continue reading the sentence as if in a straight line. It's almost this experience where your eyes are kind of feel like they're going to fall out of your head because you're trying to figure out exactly how a sentence is supposed to flow. And I think the images are kind of doing that in an interesting way too. I mean, you know, for instance, or the way that the sound mixing is with this as well. I mean, the opening scene is very interesting because he's covering so much territory visually inside this small apartment. You're on the couch, you have the perspective from the couch, you go to the refrigerator, you come back to the couch, you're looking out the window. And in addition to that, you have this thing where a character will say something and then they'll just kind of mumble off. And it's an important exposition scene. It's the classic noir setup of someone comes to a detective and they need help. But this, it's kind of being fucked with here because you have, you know, Joaquin Phoenix will say, oh, yeah. And it got audible laughs out of the New York Film Festival crowd. So I know I'm not alone in noticing this as something that was going on. And yet we get into everything with, you know, Mickey Wolfman and Dr. Rudy Blatnoid and
what is up with the names in this movie?
It's Thomas Pynchon.
Okay.
I mean, you know, his most he wrote what is one of the most difficult novels of the 20th century, and the character in that is named Tyrone Slothrop. So you know, he's not exactly keen on giving characters normal names.
Which one are you referring to?
That's Gravity's Rainbow.
Okay. All right. I was going to say, because if it's not Gravity, like, I think about the most difficult novels of the 20th century, I think Finnegan's Wake and Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, ultimately, it's, you know, it's a movie, in Twilight, yes. Twilight
different actually, difficulty, though.
21st century, though.
Is
21st
it?
Century, yeah.
Oh, it's God, we're so deep into the 21st century that I'm just like... Anyway.
So anyway, I think the movie is definitely of intense interest, and yet after like 3 months, I'm just really tired of talking about it, which is not a thing to say in a podcast review. It's just that I've been, you know, I mean, I've been thinking about it and talking about it.
You just came to the party so early, you know, you've been, while it was still playing in clubs, like, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's not interesting to me anymore.
I saw it before it was mainstream.
Yeah, exactly. You're the perfect fucking hipster.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. Okay, so Danny King, what about yourself? What did you think of Inherent Vice?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've seen this film twice now. The first time I saw it with Nick, and like you mentioned, it was, I think, like the first time the film had been screened publicly. Obviously, a very hyped environment. And while I liked the film, I did constantly feel at a distance from it. And I didn't have too strong a reaction. Then yesterday, I saw the film with my dad at home. And so we went to the Regal near us, and there were about 12 people in the theater. And by the end of the film, there were like maybe 6 people left. And I had a much stronger, more positive reaction. But it really, so by the end of the movie, there were like only 6 people left. And they were sort of like very pronounced walkouts, like couples turning to each other, picking up their jackets and slowly like leaving. But for me, I had a much stronger reaction the second time, much more positive, which I maybe should have expected because a similar thing happened with The Master. But anyway, I think it really took watching this movie away from the festival setting in this sort of suburban environment to realize how weird it is. Like, there's the scene that's sort of like very foggy, and it's Owen Wilson's first scene, and him and Joaquin Phoenix are talking, and the scene is a long drawn out push in on them in the fog, and they're whispering, and I'm sort of into the scene because I'm seeing it for the second time, and I'm pretty engaged, but like my dad mentions it and he's like, I couldn't understand a single word they're saying. And there are a lot of scenes like that, which is just like not a normal thing to do in a studio comedy. And the film played so poorly to this crowd, I'm almost surprised it got made. And I wonder how it's going to do, but like it was really jarring to watch the film, you know, with all of these, you know, PTA nerds who are into every second, and then to try to drop it with a sort of more average movie-going crowd. Like, how do you expect this movie to play to people? One of the things I admire about both this and The Master, and I agree with Nick, their style is very close to The Master, is that there's sort of these really evocative period pieces told largely through close-up and just dialogue. And I find that a really unconventional and ultimately very kind of resonant approach to period. Even the moments when Inherent Vice does get into elaborate camera movement, like there's Joaquin Phoenix is entering a party, but that tracking shot is just really on Joaquin. So it's not really like, I mean, you're getting the sense of a full setting, even though the camera is still so close to the character. And there are so many moments throughout that in the movie where it's like Anderson could really not give a crap about giving you an establishing shot and telling you that this is, you know, 1970s California. He's really communicating this period through other ways. And I find that kind of fascinating. And the other thing about this movie that struck me is the emotional connection I had the second time and the way that moments of emotion just sort of hit you out of nowhere. There's one in the scene where Joaquin Phoenix is talking to Owen Wilson's character's wife, girlfriend, and she's having how they met. And it's an absurd story of them meeting in the bathroom. And Joaquin Phoenix looks like he wants to throw up while he's listening to it because it's so gross out. And then all this character, she's talking about her heroin addiction, how it like ruined her teeth. And it's just this incredibly jarring shift between the grotesque and the lowbrow, and then this suddenly really sad material. That whole thing, that whole dynamic played much more strongly for the second time. So yeah, overall, I am positive, quite positive on the film now, even though I had kind of a reaction that was similar to Nick's the first time. And I don't know if this is just a PTA-specific thing because it also happened with The Master, but I guess with his next film, I'll wait to see it again to clarify my opinion.
Yeah, I think I have the same reaction as both of you. I only got the chance to see this once, and I honestly think that seeing it a second time might make it better for me.
Did you just see it this weekend?
Yes, I did. It only arrived. God damn you. Man, it only got to DC this weekend. I don't know what to tell you. This does solidify, however, my idea that I ought to try to make it up to some of the New York festivals. Because I live like 4 hours away. Why wouldn't I do that?
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I went to Toronto and that was like 9 hours. Anyway, it doesn't matter. What was I going to say? So this movie, I loved The Master. I didn't need more than once to see it to know that I loved it. This one, I think I kind of like respect or admire, or I like dig it, to use the parlance of the times, but I don't think that I love it. I don't even know if I'd call it good, but like when I was there in the theater with it kind of grooving along to its little jam, I was fine with it. There's a lot to admire in it. I think the performances universally are pretty good. I love a lot of the choices that are made. And I think that the world that it creates is cartoonish enough to really hold my interest without sapping away some of the greater aspects of it. For instance, one of the things that I love most was the fact that this movie seemed very aware of the fact that the things happening within the film itself were not the type of thing that you would usually expect to be in a film that looks like this. And the way that they do that, for instance, there's a point where he is walking through a brothel, and it's, you know, a normal, you know, tracking shot, following him from behind, very steady, very measured pace moving forward. And as soon as he crosses a threshold, someone whacks him with a 2x4, and he takes a couple more steps and then like kind of, you know, it's in the trailer. He turns around and he like grabs for the beads of a beaded doorway and falls. And the entire time this is happening, the camera is still moving too, as though the camera itself is like, okay, we're just in a Paul Thomas Anderson film. This is going to be one of our very austere following down a hallway shots. Oh shit, my main character just got hit in the head with a 2x4. I guess I'm just going to keep moving forward. Similarly, another shot that's in the trailer, when he's walking to a police station and a policeman just like shoves another policeman into him with such force that he falls to the ground. And again, it's like the tracking shot continues, and then suddenly he's not even in frame, and the camera has to turn and find him again. And then just the visual humor of him giving a wide berth to every other cop because he's so worried that they're going to hit him again. Things like that humor and that liveliness and that self-awareness were good, but I am a man who loves himself a good noir. I've read like every book by Raymond Chandler. I loved Brick. I mean, The Maltese Falcon, the film, is great. Long Kiss Goodbye, the film, is great. Out of the Past is great. I love noir, but I love it for a very specific reason. And this and The Big Lebowski kind of deny that reason. I still like both of these films, The Big Lebowski and this film, but they're not, I guess, you know, functioning on... I heard Paul Thomas Anderson, like, 70s noir, and I was excited. So I guess I just had to get used to the fact that I wasn't going to get what I wanted. And towards the end, I think I was more used to the fact, which is great, because if I hadn't been, the ending of this film would have kind of infuriated me. But by that point, I had shifted into its groove and kind of understood what it was going for. And so it was fine. This wouldn't have made my top 10, which I was concerned about, if you'll recall from last weekend. So I'm glad that I'm almost glad that it's not as good as I had wanted it to be, because then it would have been embarrassing to come back from our first podcast after the top 10 to say, oh, this should have been like number 3. Luckily, I don't have to do that. But yeah, I don't know what it is precisely. Maybe a second viewing will help to open the film up for me, and I'll be able to be better about it. But you know, on the whole, it's a fine film. It's a fun time at the movies. I would see it again, but it's just kind of a airless confection. So yeah,
confection.
It's a confection. It's
very interesting.
It's like it's like the cinematic equivalent of getting stoned. You know, you're not like running a marathon, you're not reading a book, you're not having a good meal. You're just getting high for a little bit, and then when it's over, you're not any worse off than you were before, but you're not any better off than you were before. And sure, you laughed a little bit, but like in general, you just kind of like seated yourself to this weird little torpor, and now it's over and you're back.
I gotta say, this movie really made me want to light up. In a way that movies normally don't. Not sure what it is, but this movie makes the whole thing seem very appealing. I think because, it is literally a hazy film. It looks like someone blew smoke in front of the camera half the time, particularly in the confrontation with Owen Wilson's character and that really wonderful two-shot. One thing I loved about this movie are the two-shots. Something just so purely enjoyable to me about watching two characters in the same image talking to each other. Maybe it's because we just don't have a lot of it anymore for some reason. David Bordwell wrote a really good piece about this. I think it's just called like what happened to the two shot. And for me, it does a really effective job of basically putting you in almost like a stone state where a shot is going on for so long. And this is one of the only instances for me where the Pynchonian dialogue actually really resonated inside sort of the cinematic frame where you have this going on sort of unraveling. I thought that was really elegant how that was done. And actually, if you watch the YouTube video of the film's press conference at NYFF, you can hear me ask Anderson a question about the two-shot, like stumbling over my words. It was very intimidating because, like, he was like, if you watch the video, the camera's focused on him. He's staring directly at me. and the entire cast is up there staring at me as I'm asking this question. I've just seen a movie, and I have to process my thoughts on it a bit. And yet, he did talk about it a bit. So, you know, there are people out there who are appreciating this. I'm glad to see that. I'm glad to see that that's kind of making a little bit of a an impact, I guess, that people were noticing it. However,
I just realized something. Catherine Waterson, is she the daughter of Sam Waterson?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, yeah.
Now I know why her face looks so familiar.
And she has the best scene in the movie, which is her, I don't even know what you'd call it exactly.
The second scene she's in?
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that scene. I think that scene captures a lot of the film inside a single shot.
It does.
A lot of the effect of it. That for me is the high point of the movie.
That film, that scene also does one of the things that I love actually about Mad Men. Mm-hmm. It's a very weird sound design thing where they're sitting on a leather couch and you hear every goddamn noise that couch is making.
Mm.
And it becomes like, I can't even remember if there's an actual soundtrack in the back of that scene. Because just the sound of the leather creaking and rubbing against itself, and just like it becomes like this dissonant atonal thing that fills the space in between and behind her words. And it was like just horrifying. And they do it in Mad Men all the goddamn time.
Mm.
And it's something that is just really strange that I've really come to love.
Ah.
Cool.
Okay.
Indeed.
That much being said, one instance where I think the film's biggest stumble is the voiceover by Joanna Newsom.
Really?
which I found very difficult to tolerate. I'm not going to, you know, not to, you know, be in a glass house and throw a stone here, because I don't think I have really the greatest voice out there.
Yeah, but, we've been meaning to talk to you about that.
Yeah. But I cannot handle her voice. Like, I seriously, that was difficult to get through. I just found it really grating in a way that nothing in an Anderson film has been grating before. I'm not sure what it's adding to the material, honestly. I think that there is an interesting little wrinkle that's added at the beginning when there is almost the sense that this is a recollection that she's making.
Right.
And I love the, you know, like the sort of the sunlit background of her as she's beginning to tell a story. I think that's great.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It felt like it was kind of stacking certain complications on top of the narrative itself. I felt like I was sort of being inundated with more and more of, again, the story that I was sort of interested in, that I sort of found compelling, but which I would kind of prefer to jettison in lieu of more of a tonal experience, right. More of a mood piece almost. And this just kind of kept coming at me. And, I don't know. I'm not sure what other people think of that. I'd be curious to hear.
About her voiceover in particular?
Yeah.
I actually was thinking about it a lot. It reminded me a lot of the voice of Laura Palmer in Twin Peaks.
Huh.
Mm. It has that same...
If only this character met the same fate.
Whoa.
Oh my gosh.
You really don't like hippies. I mean, there's something about... It's not even high-pitched. It's just... doll-like... Is that a thing that makes sense to people? Like, it's as though you can tell that they're putting it on. And it's a little aggravating because I don't understand what the purpose is. In Twin Peaks, at least, it was obviously this girl who was transitioning into womanhood who was still trying to hold on to the girlish aspects of herself that portrayed the innocence that everyone in Twin Peaks wanted to corrupt. Wow. I get that. In this movie, it's a stoned 30 to 40 something person who's telling us this story, and I don't understand why she's putting on like this baby doll voice. But it was one of the few voices that was filled with something other than like gravelly self-assurance or kind of like muddled unintelligibility, and so I actually kind of grew to love it. It was this whimsical, thoughtful counterpoint to the rest of the film. So yeah, I kind of dug it towards the end of it.
One thing that's funny is I haven't read the book, so I didn't realize until after I saw the film and started reading reviews that her character's name is Sorta Liege.
Yeah.
And so while I was watching the film a second time, there are a number of occasions where Joaquin is speaking to her and he'll just sort of drop Liege in the middle of his lines. And I was just wondering what... I was even thinking the first time I saw the movie when he said Liege, because there's like no way for me to know that that's a nickname for a full name I haven't even heard.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
He lives in a Victorian castle or something.
Yeah.
By Liege.
Yeah, that's. I thought that it was like a joking honorific.
Yeah, and I feel like they're...
Like, because she could always find pot or something, so he felt like, I don't know.
That'd be pretty complicated.
I had to create backstories like that because I'm like, I don't know what the hell's going on.
But yeah, there are so many moments like that and like the mumbling where there's just no fucks given about intelligibility. And the other thing I would say, going off Nick's point about the two shot, is I would also say I love Anderson, the way he shoots close-ups in both this and The Master at sort of a very pronounced low angle. If you think of like the scenes in The Master between Joaquin and the psychiatrists, where you can like, if you just imagine that low angle of the psychiatrist he's talking to and how his desk is very prominent, it sort of reminds me of the scenes of Brolin behind his desk. Also the scene where Joaquin and this other woman, what exactly are they huffing?
Probably nitrous.
What's that?
It's a gas. Makes you giggly and lightheaded. It's what wasn't that what Frank was doing in Blue Velvet?
Oh,
to bring it back to another David Lynch thing.
I think it was amyl nitrate.
Oh, that was that amyl nitrate for him?
Yeah, it's like
for him
it's
or for them.
For him.
Okay, what about for them in this movie?
Yeah, it was something like that. Nitrous or amyl nitrate.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever had a friend who has like a do-it-yourself whipped cream thing, but doesn't actually, you know, use it to make whipped cream? Because that's what they're doing.
Right.
Whippets, basically.
Which
I can attest to. It's the stupidest high you'll ever have. It lasts for like 12 seconds. Anyway.
Well, it's a good scene, and I like the low angle in it.
it was a very interesting scene.
But yeah, I think he's really like, I mean, the way he's directing conversations in his previous two films, I find really fascinating. Because when you think about it, what's so strange about Inherent Vice is that everyone is describing it as this kind of whacked out stoner comedy when the whole movie is just long dialogue scenes. So it's, and I think this gets back to like what Nick maybe is, and what I didn't quite get about it at first, which is just this disconnect between this really controlled, locked in style and material that seems to be very cartoonish. But for whatever reason on the second, it just went down smoother and I kind of got lost in the movie in a good way.
I really don't think I have anything else to say.
Josh Brolin. Amazing.
Oh my God. Yeah. He's actually pretty fantastic with the frozen bananas and the pancakes.
I love the shot in the car.
Yeah.
It's just him like eyeing Bigfoot eating.
And it's things like that. Like there's some intelligent humor, and then there's some fucking stupid stuff in this movie that still feels like it's being done smarter than an actual like sex comedy could come up with.
Right. Like, you know, Martin Short is Dr. Rudy Blatnoid.
Blatnoid.
Yeah.
Oh God, that whole thing.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that sequence is pretty great with the wheel and everything.
Yeah. so funny.
So what was the thing? There's something wrong with the couch in your office.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Let me take off my pants and I will come check.
Yeah, like okay. not even the pretense of, oh well, allow me to come in and see what's wrong with it. It's like, oh, all right, let me drop these. Oh my God. So do we need this is another one. Do we need to do spoilers for this? Because the plot doesn't seem to fucking matter.
There's like nothing to spoil until the last, you know, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I feel like even then there's sort of the idea the movie presents, which is that the narrative incident is not as important as the emotional resonance.
Right. So it's like what I was saying earlier, like I love noir. So like I'm so glad that I figured out early on, like, oh, this isn't gonna be like it goes all the way to the mayor's office type of thing. Like when they were talking about how, you know, it was like Wolfman was going to develop some like free community for everyone because blah blah blah, and then I was just like okay, this isn't going where I think it's going to go. I'm not going to get my usual thing. It's going to be some criticism against capitalism and, you know, the flatland, isn't that what they called it, like the Squaresville, but, you know, flatland because you can't say Squaresville because that's more square than being a square. Yeah, I'm glad that I was able to pull myself back on my expectations as a noir. As a film itself, as a comedy, as a bunch of other stuff, it's fine. But I guess I would need to reset my expectations and then go see it again to really be able to speak with authority on how good it is as itself.
I will say that even though I found the movie kind of disappointing and I am overall a bit mixed on it, I did find the last scene very haunting.
Yeah. The last
scene has really stuck with me, and particularly the last shot. I mean, it's all, the last scene is one shot, but the last, like, second of the movie or so.
Right.
I find, like, and again, I say this as someone who doesn't really like hippies at all and doesn't really care about their downfall. I suppose, you know, for me, the last moments kind of get to, like the earlier Catherine Waterston scene, those are the moments when you can kind of break through the whole counterculture veneer, and I think all the bullshit that comes with it, and get to like, something much more human.
Right, the actual humanity beneath it.
Right, and you know how these are actually people, or rather, more specifically, that they're people whose problems go deeper than the hippie lifestyle, I guess. Yeah, so I think the last... It's quite similar to The Last Shadow of the Master in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it is, I think, unrepentantly bleak. I don't think there's anything... I don't think there's any sign of a happy ending in this movie, except for, you know, except for one narrative. One,
right, right.
Except for, like, one shot that I actually found very moving in a way I wasn't expecting. You know, if you're not sure what I'm talking about, it involves, like, sitting outside a house in a car. that should tell you. But, there's really nothing about the final scene that has much redemption to it. And that was surprising. That was very effectively keyed into. I think Anderson is very good at being emotionally crushing when you kind of least expect it. It's something that he does better than most people, I found. And this is, I think ultimately the movie is a good example of that, even if there are some bumps in the road along the way.
And I will say that I can't wait for someone to hand me their phone to show me a picture where I can just scream for half a second at the top of my lungs and then attempt to regain composure.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to do that shit all the time to people. Well, that's it. That's the end of our Inherent Vice review. If you have your own thoughts on the film, let us know at podcast@thefilmstage.com or tweet us at Filmstage Show. Now let's get into what's coming out to DVD and Blu-ray. On the 13th of January, Gone Girl, a film that none of us had on our top 10 list, even though I know a lot of other people had it on theirs. That's just the kind of counterculture revolutionary thinking you'll get on this show.
Really liked it, though.
Yeah, it was fine. Well, Walk Among the Tombstones, however, a film that was on one of our top 10 lists, is coming to Blu-ray as well.
Really like that one, too.
Yeah. We also have... Oh, where did he go? A movie called Wetlands, which I remember hearing about, but don't really know what it is about. Men, Women, and Children.
Oh, man.
Which I still need to see like a motherfucker.
Yeah.
Revenge of the Green Dragons, which I remember hearing about and people being disappointed in. That's all the new ones. Beyond that, there's a lot of other stuff coming out. Capricorn 1 is a cult sci-fi thing. The Bitter Tears of Petra? What? I don't believe I know that film. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff coming out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant.
Okay.
Great Fassbinder.
And Fitzcarraldo is coming to Blu-ray. I don't know if it's already been there or not. But yeah, that's it. Any of these really striking your fancy, guys? I will throw down for Walk Among the Tombstones getting a rent from anyone who's interested.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. No doubt.
Gone Girl as well.
There's a film called The River's Edge. I've been curious to see for a while, but...
Well, it's got Crispin Glover in it, so...
Yeah, it's got Dennis Hopper, Keanu Reeves, kind of as an interesting look to it.
Nick, you want to put out any thoughts on any of these things?
Yeah, I like Gone Girl a lot.
Okay.
There you go.
All right, well, let's talk about the films that are coming to theaters next week. I know that we will be talking about Black Hat, the newest film by Michael Mann.
Yeah,
motherfucking Black Hat. Anyway, so the newest film by Michael Mann, Black Hat, starring Chris Hemsworth, who I find to be a very charismatic, fun to watch actor. So I'm looking forward to that. Another movie I'm really looking forward to is Paddington. No love for Paddington. This is the live action adaptation of the classic British children's books, Paddington Bear. A bear who comes from the deepest, darkest Peru and lives with a family in London. And he wears a jaunty little cap and a coat with toggles on it. And he loves marmalade. I was a huge Paddington fan as a kid. When I was actually down in Texas over the Christmas break, I found my old Paddington stuffed bear. So, and I've heard that this movie is actually really, really good. So I'm excited to see it because I still get a kick out of family films now and then. We also have The Wedding Ringer, an execrable-looking comedy which is sad because Kevin Hart is such a charismatic guy that I hate to see him get stuck in a movie that looks that bad. Still Alice coming to theaters. A lot of awards consideration for Julianne Moore's performance there. That's about it. There's a couple of other things coming out, but I don't feel like talking about them. Guys, aside from Black Hat, obviously, which I said we'll be talking about next week, any thoughts on any of these films? Okay, moving on. Let's talk about something that we've watched in our own time, briefly, over the last couple weeks, and let's tell the people what we thought about it. So, Nick Newman, why don't we start with you? Why don't you briefly give us your thoughts on a film that you saw that you feel we should check out?
Well, there's a whole year's worth of options already, aren't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Son of a bitch.
It's been a good film viewing year thus far. For instance, I saw John Wick.
Yes.
Which is really something.
Tell me it was amazing.
Yeah, no, I had a great time.
Excellent.
You don't see action like that in American movies anymore, do you? So that
no,
was
you
really
don't.
Great.
That's refreshing.
You know what? I'll just recommend that. Why not? Because it didn't really make that much money. And I think also when Taken 3 makes $40.5 million at the box office on its opening weekend and John Wick is in the second run theater pretty quickly, it's just, oh, God.
No, it's so
you stupid people don't know what's good for you. But not you, the listener.
Right.
Just the American public in general. But no, John Wick is really a great time. I actually, my sort of little buzz term for it is that I think it kind of finds the common ground between Bresson and Bioshock in a way that I never would have thought that something could mine the best qualities of both of those and work coherently, cohesively. And yet here is John Wick, a movie that puts a strong emphasis on the physical action of a body, and in particular the use of hands, while also building a very convincing alternate world that has a very lived-in feel to it, that goes unexplained in a way I found very exciting.
Yeah, you know, it is a great world they create.
I think the movie, like most action films, goes on a bit too long. You know, I mean, it kind of, at some point it feels like there are about 30 endings to the movie, but each ending is fun, and the experience of watching a movie with that sort of built on inevitability is interesting, where it's not a question of if John Wick is going to kill them, it's just when and how.
Yeah.
And you know, when was the last time you saw a film that used the word oh so well? So the John Leguizamo character calls the Michael Nyquist character and says, what did my son do where you hit him or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, well, he came in here. He killed John Wick's dog and stole his car. It's just, oh.
Oh, yeah. yeah, Michael Nyquist's character when he's just like, oh, and then he just hangs up.
Yeah.
And then yeah. John Leguizamo's like, yep, I'm pretty sure that I got out of that.
That's the thing of beauty.
All right. Well, yeah, John Wick from Nick Newman.
I think it's streaming now. I think you can get it from like Amazon and iTunes.
Oh, fantastic. Well, check out John Wick. I loved that movie. So I will second Nick's recommendation. Danny King, what about yourself? Something you saw that you feel we should check out?
Well, I will third Nick's recommendation, if I may.
Yeah, John Wick. Making it work.
And then last night, I watched a really great comedy, Kingpin, the Farrelly Brothers movie. Recently, I sort of double-billed their Dumb and Dumber movies and liked them quite a bit. But this one seemed to be on another level in a good way. I laughed hysterically throughout it. And it also, like the best moments in their Dumb and Dumber movies, has a real, like, authentic emotional quality to it. But Kingpin, it just creates this hilarious world of bowling where Woody Harrelson plays a star bowling prospect who gets his hand cut off. And then he ends up training Randy Quaid, who's an Amish man who could be a potentially good bowler. And it just goes through this really funny underworld of gambling on bowling games. And then Bill Murray plays a sort of like womanizing top bowler. And there's really hilarious ESPN style commentary where he'll like hit a strike and then he'll just turn to the crowd and he'll be like, where are the women at? Where are the women? And then the ESPN commentators are like, what a role model for children. He will be running for political office one day. And the movie throughout is just insanely sharp and clever and really good. It's like I just had a great time watching it.
All right. Excellent. I'm going to talk about a documentary that I saw on Netflix. It is called I Know That Voice. And this is a documentary on voice actors, actually. And it's a really interesting look at a part of Hollywood and, I guess, media and entertainment in general that you don't really get to see a lot. It's done by John DiMaggio, who is the voice of Bender, as well as Jake the dog from Adventure Time, for all of our stoner listeners. And he goes out and interviews a truckload of voice actors, and you really do get a film that it really helps you to understand something that I think a lot of people see as like a very easy, simple aspect, or even an invisible aspect of Hollywood. And this makes it just so much more vividly realized. It's written by Brandon Sonier and directed by Lawrence Shapiro. I don't know what else they've done, but this is a very fun movie. There's a point where they're all these different voice actors that they're speaking to are talking about what they're doing, and then they all start doing Shakespeare in various different character voices, making the point that, like, you know, someone might be able to do a perfect Homer Simpson Doe, which I can't do, so I won't attempt to do it, but that unless you could convincingly read Shakespeare in a Homer Simpson voice, like, you can't actually say that you can do the voice. You can mimic, but you can't actually inhabit the character. And so it's little insights like that that make this a movie that's well worth watching. It's on Netflix Instant. It's also streaming on Amazon Prime, I believe. It's a good companion to another film that I watched, actually, called In a World, where Lake Bell is a female voiceover artist who is kind of trying to get the newest gig for a trailer that actually is going to use the term In a World, which is, you know, as you can imagine, a huge thing in the voiceover community. That movie is not quite as good as this documentary. It's just a little too... a little too much. But in general, it's a very fine film, and one that I would not dissuade anyone from watching if you are interested. Lake Bell is great. I love Lake Bell. So stick with that. Check it out. That is all for today, however. So join us next week when we'll be discussing Black Hat. In the meantime, let's tell the fine folks at home where we can be found on the internet. Danny King.
TheFilmSage.com. Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, and all over.
All right. Nick Newman.
TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and any restaurants that show a sense of respect.
And,
that was funny.
Oh, my God. I can be found on my personal site, DearFilm.net, as well as TheFilmStage.com. Also, Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And you can find me cruising the Strand at Gordita Beach. So thanks once again, ladies and gentlemen. We look forward to seeing you next time. Want to finish recording and then go eat some chicken wings?
Hello?
Hey, you're back. So thank you in advance, everyone, for joining us next week, and have a great year. Have a great year? What the fuck am I talking about?